This week on The Right Side, the Bloc Québécois fractures under poor leadership, leaving questions for 2019. Stephen Mandel's Alberta Party win shifts the party to the former Progressive Conservative control. China's government takes over BC seniors' care, and we cover why Trudeau's budget is not as good as it seems. This is The Right Side, episode 58, recorded Thursday, March 1st, 2018. $18 billion in the hole. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. We're back this week, Patrick and myself.
It's good to be back. We're now into March, so a new month brings a lot of new opportunities to talk about all the crazy news that comes out, eh?
Indeed. And, you know, some of the news that we're talking about this week, you might think there might have been a deficit on reporting in terms of that. But, of course, we'll get to that and its numerous meanings later on in the podcast, of course. If you're joining us for the first time, though, The Right Side is a podcast that aims to cut through the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media. And what's not exactly reported in good volume in the media as well, because, you know, we can go through tons and tons of these stories for the podcast, and, you know, it's oftentimes that it's not until you get to the sixth or seventh one that you discover something completely different and a narrative that is totally missing. And that's what we do here. We provide that information and context to put you on the right side of the news. So we're going to shake the order up a bit this week, and we're going to start with Canada. So what do you got for us?
Yeah, so we've got some shocking political news out of Quebec, actually. 7 out of 10 Bloc Québécois MPs resigned from caucus to protest the leadership of Martine Ouellette. Now, Ouellette, who does not sit in the House of Commons, is an elected Parti Québécois member of the National Assembly of Quebec, and until now has been unknown in the media. We haven't really heard anything about her, either good or bad, at all. So it appears that Ouellette's strong stance on Quebec separatism has alienated most of her now former caucus. The departing MPs believed that the Bloc Québécois should be promoting Quebec interests above all others, including separatism, which is a stance that Ouellette seemingly disagrees with. And it was also mentioned that Ouellette was not listening to their concerns. Now, even before the schism, the Bloc caucus was far smaller than at its peak in the early 90s, when fractured right-wing parties actually led to a Bloc Québécois official opposition after the 1993 election. However, its support has declined in recent years as the party won 4 seats in 2011 and just 10 in 2015, with the orange crush of the NDP dominating the province. And it has continued to attract about 20% of the vote in Quebec in recent elections and polls. And if the party ends up collapsing because of this shocking news, it actually stands to leave a number of ridings up for grabs in Quebec in the next election in 2019, which is providing an opportunity particularly for the Conservatives and the NDP to make gains in the province. Now, the Bloc has regularly faced internal upheaval over the years, but Louis Plamondon, who is the Dean of the House of Commons, said the party has now hit rock bottom. He said, quote, "I have seen a number of crises in the Bloc Québécois. There is no doubt this is the biggest," said Plamondon, who was first elected as a Progressive Conservative in 1984, and he now opposes Ouellette's leadership. Plamondon said previous Bloc leaders such as Lucien Bouchard and Gilles Duceppe always managed to patch things up, but that did not happen in this case. Now, in an interview, former leader Duceppe said the writing is on the wall for Ouellette. He says it pretty plainly, quote, "When 70% of a caucus doesn't see its priorities reflected by the leader, he or she has to leave. Secondly, I don't think that the Bloc has to choose between promoting sovereignty or defending Quebec's interests. You can do both at the same time as we used to do." Now, Ouellette, who's been sitting in the National Assembly since 2010, she finished third in the Parti Québécois leadership race in Quebec in 2016, and she ended up running for Bloc leader last year. And she said that she's still promising to run for the Bloc in 2019 and that she will not quit as leader. She said, quote, "I'm staying on. I was elected by BQ members. They are the ones who gave me my mandate." So unless Quebec sovereigntists find a way of winning the provincial election later this year, the Bloc vote stands to collapse in the 2019 federal election, pollster Jean-Marc Léger said. He added that among federalist politicians, the biggest victim of the Bloc's unraveling stands to be Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He says, quote, "What is obvious is that the Bloc voters won't go to the Liberal Party. The Conservatives are more likely to benefit, along with the NDP to a lesser extent, given the left-wing faction in the party. Overall, these are voters who oppose Justin Trudeau." Carl Vallée, who is a Quebec strategist in the former Conservative government of Stephen Harper, said the Bloc voters will tend to react differently whether they live in Montreal or in the rest of Quebec. Said Mr. Vallée, who's now a partner at Hatley Strategies, he said, quote, "In rural areas, it could help the Conservatives because these are what we call blue voters. On the island of Montreal, there's a direct link between the Bloc and NDP voters." Now, CBC pollster Eric Grenier disagrees, thinking that the Liberals will benefit the most from a Bloc fracture. He says that in 8 of the 10 BQ ridings, the Liberals placed either second or a very strong third. He said, quote, "Considering the Liberals have made significant gains in popular support in the province since, that would put Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in a good position to pick up all 10 seats in 2019. As for the NDP, Grenier points to polls that suggest that Quebecers, and Bloc supporters in particular, are the least likely to vote for a party led by a leader wearing visible religious symbols, such as the turban-wearing Sikh. He says that the Conservatives might have an opportunity to pick up more nationalist-minded Bloc voters, but that identity issues might shy away some voters. So what will this do to the 2019 race? As we say a lot on this show, we'll have to just wait and see. One thing is for sure, 2019 will be a very interesting year, and there's no way of knowing what will happen in the election.
And this is a key point here heading into 2019, is that without the Bloc being a major force, that completely changes the dynamics of what you see going on in Quebec. I've personally been a long proponent that a government-based strategy similar to what was run in the 1980s with the collapse of the NDP and the collapse of the Bloc could ultimately lead to some kind of similar conservative coalition coming out of Quebec as we saw with the Mulroney government. So this is playing right into that idea of what could potentially be happening in 2019. And I think Eric Grenier has it wrong here because, you know, these votes are ripe for the picking. And as it's been said, these voters would not have initially went for Justin Trudeau in the first place.
Exactly. Otherwise, they wouldn't be voting Bloc if they liked Trudeau, right? Because mainly Bloc is a single issue party, but for the most part, they do skew towards the left on most issues. So that's the reason why a lot of Bloc voters ended up going to the NDP back in 2011, because there were a lot of younger people that didn't really see a case for Quebec sovereignty, but still agreed with a lot of the more socialist ideals of the NDP, which is why they ended up voting for them. So I'm not entirely sure why Grenier thinks that the Liberals will pick up all 10 seats in 2019 when it's pretty clear that the Bloc wouldn't actually vote for them.
Yeah, and I think if there's anything we've learned in the last number of years, you know, whether it's Alberta or even in the U.S. election, past trends are not necessarily an indicator of what will happen going forward. So, you know, it could be an entirely different game in Quebec in 2018 or 2019 rather, and it would be a bad idea if the Conservatives wrote Quebec off again. So we'll just have to wait and see, as you said, in the end of that story.
That's for sure.
All right. So we're going to move on to Alberta right now. And, you know, this week we had the spring fiscal update delivered by the finance minister, which on its own had lots of news in it about, you know, that the fact that The deficit has shrunk just a little bit. It's only around $9 billion now. But at the end of the day, you know, we are still seeing investment going away from the province. And he admits that there is work that needs to be done to bring investment back. And he said it's going to be a lot of work going forward, when in reality, they could just decide to, you know, offer tax cuts and whatnot to the corporations and just lower the overall tax burden to make business in Alberta more competitive. We could indeed be talking about that this week, but there is actually a big story that came out of the Alberta Party this week, that Alberta Party leadership race, is that Stephen Mandel won the Alberta Party leadership race. And, you know, that we could have went with an alternate headline here, but I'm going to save that for just a little bit, because you'll see why. So Mandel won with 66% of the vote on the first ballot. Second place was Kara Levi's with 18%, and Rick Fraser, the former UCP and Progressive Conservative MLA, came in third at 16%. And for anyone listening who might not be from Alberta, or you might not pay attention to what went on in Edmonton, Mandel was the mayor of Edmonton from October 2004 to October 2013. He was also health minister in Jim Prentice's Progressive Conservative government. And, you know, it's a little bit interesting to see him moving to the Alberta Party, because the Alberta Party was first founded in 1985, but really didn't gain much traction throughout the years until the 2015 election, when they elected their first MLA, who was Greg Clark, the former leader. So in 2010, the Alberta Party effectively reimaged itself as a centrist political option, aiming to be fiscally responsible yet socially progressive, aiming to get those votes in, you know, downtown Calgary, downtown Edmonton, that might not have wanted to vote for the NDP. So that's what the Alberta Party is about. And Mandel in the race was very interesting, and you're going to see why in just a moment. So soon after being declared winner, Mandel said that the Alberta Party is not just here to be an alternative. We're also here not to be an also-ran. We're not here to be talking about 2023. We're here to earn your vote in every single Alberta community and to be the first choice for government in the next election. Winning in 2019 means winning the hearts and minds of Albertans in every corner of our province. Mandel won the race with 3,045 votes of the 4,613 votes that were cast in total. And during the race, the party's membership increased to 6,543 members from the roughly 1,500 or so that they had before. So that's, you know, about that increased on the factor of around 5 or 500%, as people in the media like to say for emphasis. Now, comparatively, this is four times larger than the group who elected David Kahn as Liberal leader, but is much smaller than the 58,200 who elected Jason Kenney as the leader of the United Conservative Party. So as you can see, you know, the Alberta Party is bigger than the Alberta Liberals, but it's nowhere near as big as the United Conservative Party. And they also have funding issues that both the NDP and the United Conservative Party don't have. So they got a lot of work going ahead of them heading into 2019. Now, you might be wondering, okay, why did Mandel win? Well, in actuality, there were very few policy differences in the race between the contenders, but one differing point was that on a PST. Kara Levi said during the campaign that a PST should be considered. Well, both Mandel and Fraser disagreed with the idea, and that was their official stance on the provincial sales tax, which Alberta is the only province in Canada who does not have one. Now, on the day of the leadership race concluded, former leader Greg Clark mused that a provincial sales tax should be something that the Alberta Party would consider going forward. And this was when he was still leader. And this is actually important, because Clark has been since named the party's finance critic. So he will be providing feedback on the NDP budget and whatnot when that arrives, and speaking for the Alberta Party in that role. We'll have to see whether it's his ideas regarding budgeting or Mandel's ideas that come to the forefront with that. Now, it should also be known that the Alberta Party was the first political party in Alberta to start talking about a PST in the sense of the 2019 election. That's going to happen in about a year or so from now. We already know that Jason Kenney and the UCP say there will be no sales tax, and I think we can count on the NDP in their next election campaign to probably mention a provincial sales tax. And if they don't, well, it could be a case of selective omission, as was the case with the carbon tax. Now, this leadership race went off without a hitch, relatively. And, you know, that's fine, and that's all well and good. But what was ultimately absent in media coverage of this race was that a critical makeup of looking at Mandel's campaign team and platform behind that. And with that comes also a lack of examining his tenure as mayor of Edmonton. He negotiated the expensive Edmonton Arena deal with Daryl Cates, and that ultimately received a good chunk of taxpayer money from the city, so voters should be considering that going into 2019. And he also oversaw capital projects such as the 23rd Avenue Interchange in southern Edmonton that were both late and over budget. So there's that. And there was also the makeup of his campaign team. And some of these people might ring a bell in your head if you are familiar to Alberta politics. Here's some of their names right now. Stephen Carter, Susan Elliott, Catherine O'Neill. Stephen Carter ran Alison Redford's leadership campaign for the Progressive Conservatives. Susan Elliott managed the 2012 PC election campaign, and Catherine O'Neill was the PC party president after the 2015 election defeat of that party. And there were also numerous former PC MLAs and operatives at the party's AGM back in November. And this was largely absent during the campaign and was only talked about briefly once Mandel entered the race. Following his victory this past Tuesday, only two mainstream media outlets reported this, one of which was the Globe and Mail in a syndicated column, which appeared also in the Toronto Star, National Post, and Edmonton Metro, to just name a few. And the CBC also reported on this, but did not mention any of the individuals by name. So at this point, it's safe to say that the Progressive Conservative takeover of the Alberta Party is complete. And with this being in mind, perhaps the news headlines after this should have read, Stephen Mandel, elected leader of the PC Alberta Party. Because if that's who's running his campaign, that's something that's going to be in the forefront going forward.
Yeah, that's right. And it's hard to see that Greg Clark, who is still in the legislature, will have much of a control over the party that he used to run. And with Mandel's campaign team being heavily former PC, it's going to shift the party a lot to the right, I would think, away from their centrist roots. And it'll be hard to see if they're going to remain that fiscally responsible yet socially progressive party that they set out to be.
Yeah, and another thing that's going to have to be asked, and I don't know who is going to ask this, but, you know, a question that would come up is that, you know, all these PC folks were engaged in the last two PC governments, and the question should be, have you guys learned your lesson from the past, or are you guys just looking for another quick way back to power? Because if they have not learned their lesson, then they are effectively trying to sell Albertans on a new label, and that is the Alberta Party, when it is indeed the same people that were running that government previously. So, and, you know, I think people deserve to know that, because if you asked, you know, the Alberta Party members if they knew who was running Mandel's campaign, unless they were directly associated with Mandel, I don't think that they would have realized that they were effectively voting for the old Progressive Conservative executive team, especially, you know, Catherine O'Neill, Stephen Carter, Susan Elliott. Those are some pretty heavy PC heavyweights there. So.
And you also have to think that the 5,000 or so new members that showed up, maybe they're people that were former Progressive Conservative voters and they're disgruntled with the UCP for whatever reason, and they're wanting to vote for remnants of the old PC members. So you have to think that the 5,000 of those new members might outweigh the 1,500 or so that there were before, which could also mean that there's a huge takeover, because you have to remember he won by 66%, and 66% is a lot more than 5,000 of those new members. So if he was one of the ones to sign up the most members and those members ended up voting for him, that could also spell the ideological shift of the party, because it just means that all of his former supporters, either as mayor or as a PC MLA, it could mean that they just shifted with him, and now he's going to have a chance to remake the party in his own mold.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that's missed by this is that Alberta Party, initially when it was, reemerged on the forefront in 2009 or around 2010, felt as though that they wanted to do politics differently. And I think that with this shift, that's going to be effectively lost. And that's too bad for the people that resurrected the party around that time. So
that's right.
All right. What do we got for BC this week?
All right, so there's an interesting headline out of the BC paper, The Tyee, which is an independent news organization that one could say skews their news coverage to the left, especially on environmental issues. But as we've said before, at the right side, we don't just look at mainstream outlets, but everywhere for news, as indeed many big media companies often do not focus on the smaller, less reported stories that are just as important. The Tyee's Paul Wilcox wrote a pretty alarming article entitled How the Chinese Government Took Control of BC Seniors' Homes. So for this, we'd have to go back just over a year ago in February 2017, all the way back to episode 5 for the first right side coverage on the story, when it was reported by the Globe and Mail that the Trudeau government had greenlit the sale of one of BC's biggest retirement home chains to a Beijing-based insurance titan, Anbang Insurance Group. And it was a deal that gave China a foothold in Canada's healthcare system. Now, Anbang's spent an estimated $1 billion to buy Retirement Concepts, which operates 21 senior homes in BC. It's the biggest private provider in the province, which collects $87 million from the provincial government back in the 2015-16 fiscal year. Now, Anbang had no experience in seniors' care, and its finances were murky and ownership so tangled as to be incomprehensible. It offered no promises of additional investment in the company or increased employment, and concerns about its business practice were already widespread at the time, as we mentioned back then on episode 5. So on Friday, the Chinese government seized control of Anbang Insurance Group, which of course is a financial giant with investments around the world. The government cited corruption, fraud, and a risk that the whole $390 billion company could go broke. Now, the Tyee article blames the former PC Liberal government for allowing the takeover, but ultimately this was in the hands of Ottawa. To promote its pro-China agenda, the Trudeau government turned a blind eye to the risks and shifted them to seniors. Ottawa quickly approved the takeover, and the government offered no objections and transferred operating licenses to the Chinese company. Canadian officials at the time said that their review of the takeover included a screening for any potential impact on national security. No issues were raised, which a spokesperson for the Innovation, Science, and Economic Minister, Navdeep Bains, said at the time. And after this year, has Trudeau's pro-China agenda really gotten him anywhere? He left China in December after a frosty visit with no trade deal in hand, and his dealings with China could have a huge impact on NAFTA negotiations with the U.S. So last week's Chinese government takeover is no surprise. When the sale was debated in the House of Commons last year, Conservative Mark Strahl asked what would happen, quote, when the Anbang House of Cards finally collapses. He asked, are seniors about to find out that their landlord is actually the People's Republic of China? And as Wilcox asks, if the Chinese government's goal is to save Anbang, what pressure will be put on its global properties to deliver more cash, and how will that affect residents? Will Chinese government pressure force managers to cut costs on basics? Seniors advocate Isabel McKenzie reported last month that only 15% of facilities were meeting the guideline of 3.36 hours of direct care per resident per day, an improvement over the previous year, believe it or not. And the reality is that a lack of staff to meet residents' needs translates into dramatic reductions in quality of life. So in conclusion, it's clear that the Trudeau government should have never approved such a takeover, as we could even see back then that it would have a terrible end on the horizon. And just a year later, we're seeing the results of that. And with Premier John Horgan setting record levels in healthcare spending in the spring budget, one wonders what his plan will be for BC seniors who are quite suffering, quite literally, under communist China's rule.
And, you know, this raises a very important question for the Canadian federal government. And it pertains to foreign ownership of Canadian assets and what is an acceptable limit. And I remember we were discussing this on episode 5, like you said. And it seemed as though at the time that, you know, everyone was completely oblivious to the fact that it was run by a Chinese company out of communist China, believe it or not. And you know, in hindsight, looking back on this, it's really silly that something like this was allowed to happen. And, you know, you would expect, oh, maybe it's going to be a mining company or maybe it's going to be a software company or something like that. But this is a healthcare company that takes care of seniors that made its way into the hands of the Chinese. And here we are seeing the problems with that right here. So the question is what would be too far for this government to hand over to control of a foreign entity?
That's right. And it's not like they even sold it to a Chinese company that specializes in healthcare. No, they sold it to an insurance company. Now, insurance companies, they're all about the bottom line when it comes to profit and dollars. They're not really concerned about people and victims, because after all, victims that need insurance, those are basically people that cost the company. So when it comes to healthcare and seniors, there's going to be a consistent money loss through that. So you have to think that if there needs to be more money, as you would expect in BC, that the Chinese government is not going to shell out this money for it. And you'd have to think that with the ownership detailed, as we noted back on episode 5, as being relatives of former leaders such as Deng Xiaoping, who was, of course, the former premier of the People's Republic of China, you'd have to think that the Chinese government already at the time had some sort of, you know, fingers into the company. And this really wasn't a surprise at all, so that's why we did this follow-up, just to see how exactly it's actually impacted people over the last year.
Yeah,
and it's really crazy how this has happened and that it was allowed to happen in the first place.
And what's more is there doesn't seem to be any actual media coverage of this here in Canada going on, because everyone is of course worried with the other issues that Trudeau has been dealing with in regards to India recently. So anyways, that is just really astounding that something like that was able to be put under communist Chinese control.
Yeah, and the fact that the media hasn't reported on it whatsoever in the past year. There was just that one article from the Globe and Mail back then, and just the Tai is reporting on it right now. They're not, no one is talking about it whatsoever, so it's going very underreported. And I think if you went to people on the street and asked them, did you know that the Chinese government is taking over our healthcare system, people would be like, what? But it's actually happening.
They would think that would be another conspiracy theory.
Yeah, or another sensationalist headline, but believe it or not, it's actually true, right?
All right. Well, speaking of things that are actually true, and, you know, it's not necessarily a good thing to be true, this week the federal budget was also tabled, and this federal budget brings with it an $18.6 billion deficit for the coming year. And by 2022, 2023, that'll shrink to only $12.5 billion. That I mean, we would like to be surprised here, but I don't think we are.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, this normally would be a huge issue, but both the opposition and the media have still been very concerned with the Atwal case that we talked about on last week's episode. That's still being talked about. I think we're at the point now where conspiracy theories are being actively talked about in the mainstream media regarding this, and finger pointing between the two countries is happening with this over something that should relatively have been resolved simply. But here we are, a week and a half later, and we're still talking about that in the media. And it's unfortunate, because the budget should have also taken a bigger viewpoint on this, because $18.6 billion, that is just astounding for a budget when we are experiencing a period of economic growth. But more on that in just a moment. So today, it was announced that Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale also prevented a senior security official from testifying on the Atwal matter. So, you know, while the government would like to be focused on the budget and selling the budget, Ralph Goodale had to make this decision regarding the security official in terms of the Atwal case. So I think Atwal is what the government is talking about because they have to talk about that. And they would much rather be talking about the budget, but I don't know. I think both are pretty bad stories for the government. And when it comes to us here, we already gave our view on Atwal last week, so we're going to talk about the budget right now, but both are equally astounding that we're still talking about them. So as you know, the government would probably want us to move on and, you know, accept this $18.6 billion deficit. And the reason they would want us to accept that is because the debt to GDP ratio is still going to be decreasing. That means our overall debt burden in terms of how much the Canadian economy produces is going down, despite the fact that the deficit is remarkably high. And you know, you can see this in the budget document, because the budget document itself is filled with figures comparing Canada to countries like Italy and Japan, who have over 100% debt to GDP ratio. So that's supposed to make us feel fine that our debt to GDP ratio, which is somewhere in the range of 28 to 30% with an $18.6 billion budget deficit, isn't actually too bad.
And now, honestly, I don't think you should be talking about Italy when you're comparing your economic growth and your budgets, because Italy is not really known for having a strong economy ever, really.
Yeah, Italy was on that table as well as Japan. So they were talking about Italy in the official government document. And you see, this is what the budget is. We are talking about this budget and we have the very fact in this document that the government compares itself to Italy, which is not a stable financial house by any means. So take that for what it's worth. Now, you might be wondering, why are deficits in times of economic growth bad? Well, typically, if the economy is growing well, you know, north of 3%, and as we've talked about before, a booming economy is anywhere between probably 4 and 6% growth, we're at around 3%, which is good. And yet, we're still spending in the hole of $18 billion a year, and this is remarkably bad because it means that if a recession comes sometime in 2018 or in 2019, and the government needs to make an adjustment, there is less cash on hand to make that adjustment and further ramp up spending from where it is right now, because that's what governments typically do when the economy shrinks, is they will include more spending in an attempt to get the economy growing. But the thing is, we're already spending at levels that we would be spending at if we were in a mild recession, yet we are experiencing 3% positive GDP growth. So you can only imagine what would happen if we were hit by a recession, or even worse, a recession similar to 2008. We would probably see the budget deficit double overnight based on that. And you know, this was reiterated by Jean-Francois Perrault, who is the chief economist for Scotiabank, and he said that high spending ways raise questions if the government will be able to navigate rough economic waters in the future. So he has this same idea that, you know, if something bad happens in the future, are we going to be able to spend our way out of it without causing too much debt or doubling the deficit? So with increasing amounts of program spending and debt, you would expect that our economy would be taking off. But on average, since Q2 of 2016, quarter two, it has grown at about 3.2%. So it's okay, but it could obviously be better. And that's what we're getting for this $18.6 billion that we're in the hole. Now, the Phoenix Pay System was also addressed in this budget. The Phoenix Pay System is the beleaguered pay system that's used to pay federal government employees. Sometimes people don't get paid enough or at all. Sometimes people get paid too much, and the government has been constantly working to try and fix this. So with this budget, an additional $430 million was committed to address its problem, as well as $16 million towards eventual replacement. So we're going to be sinking over $1 billion into the system that the government already wants to replace. So that's a huge chunk of where we are with this budget deficit right now. And I mean, you just have to scratch your head when you see these numbers. $1 billion for a system that we're going to scrap, and we're spending $16 million on looking how to figure out a replacement. That is just huge money that could better be spent for actual programs for Canadians on this regard. And $1 billion spent into the system. In what world does it make sense to throw something away where you have already put $1 billion into it? That just seems totally absurd at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when they're already spending that much. So in total, they'll be spending $1.5 billion about to just to try and fix the problem and to try and replace it with a better system.
It's utterly astounding. And you would think by this point, if this is in this budget, what does it bring for everyday Canadians? Well, that is answered by looking at the budget's wording itself, with the word gender appearing at least 330 times in this budget document. And the goal of this, of course, according to the government, is to bring groups that the government feels is disadvantaged forward. And you might be wondering, okay, well, what are these groups? And the main group they're talking about in this case is women. And some highlights for this refer to the paternity leave expansion that was in this budget, as well as pay equity. So currently a new family can take 35 weeks of paid leave, and under this budget this is expanded to 40 weeks as long as the second parent claims at least 5 weeks. In the last budget that the government introduced, they expanded to an 18-month parental leave, and with this new budget, the second parent can take up to 8 weeks of leave with this. And the goal with this is to allow the dad of the new child to stay home, enabling the mom to return to work sooner if she wants to do that. And the government's idea behind this is that this will enable women to get back into the workforce and not disrupt their careers and in turn make higher wages than they would normally. So also reported on the idea of paternity leave is a quote that comes from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and they feel that this is a, quote, missed opportunity because the government didn't raise the EI benefits that are available to new parents with this. And they would see a similar model to Quebec's model, where paternity leave there covers up to 70% of the total income. The budget will allocate $1.2 billion over 5 years for this program and $345 million a year thereafter. It is due to become available in June of 2019. Now, in regards to pay equity, the government wants to bridge the gap for the average 12 cents per hour wage gap that exists between men and women. No details were provided on how they want to achieve this, but people were assured that it will be coming in the next few months when the budget implementation bill is tabled. And with this, the government is also attacking the NDP in this budget because these are two very core NDP principles, and the government added another one into this budget by promising to look at universal pharmacare, and that is a policy that is a part of the new NDP national platform. So with that being said, and looking at what we've talked about so far, you have to be asking, what's being done to ensure that we have sustainable growth going forward for the economy? Well, the answer is not really much, because, you know, there isn't a good amount of business investment talked about in this budget document until much later in the document. So while it increases, you know, spending on various programs and whatnot, it does so in a way that doesn't make the economy grow by leaps and bounds. And this problem is exacerbated by the fact that the United States recently brought in one of the largest tax cuts in history. And previously, Canada had a double-digit tax advantage over the United States in terms of corporate tax by about 10%, give or take. But now the United States has the corporate tax advantage by about 2 percentage points. This, combined with the American dollar, makes U.S. investment much more attractive inside the continental United States compared to Canada. And this is ultimately the biggest issue with this budget, is that there's nothing done to make Canada more competitive with the U.S. or other jurisdictions when it comes to business investment. And as we've talked about many times before here on the podcast, when it comes to business investment, that is what ultimately adds new wealth into the Canadian economy. So Precision Drilling is one of the largest oil companies in Canada, and they have said that they will be not investing new capital into Canada, and instead will focus on the U.S., Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates. Bill Morneau claims that he's watching the U.S., and on Wednesday, speaking to the Economic Club of Canada in Ottawa, he said that Ottawa will focus on making immediate worries like NAFTA and U.S. Lower U.S. corporate taxes, and at the same time will be taking steps to address longer-term domestic risks like the aging workforce. And he feels that our brightening economy, those are his exact words, allows the government to play the long game and fully take stock of what's happening in the U.S. So while Bill Morneau says this, it's not until page 288 of page 369 that business investment is ultimately thought of in this budget document. So real business investment would actually look like a reduction in red tape through cutting regulations or just tax cuts in general to encourage businesses to come to Canada and invest. So anything that could be seen as investment is really just a small sprinkling of money at subsidies for projects like the Industrial Research Assistance Plan, and that's just one example. All of this comes as on Thursday, Statistics Canada reported that direct investment in Canada dropped 26% in 2017 alone to $33.8 billion. And according to Bloomberg, ConocoPhillips and Royal Dutch Shell are among the companies that led the exodus from the nation's energy sector last year. So with that being said, if the budget doesn't attempt to create economic growth in any meaningful way, is it actually a budget? And in concert with this, if you look at the Bloomberg piece, there's actually a nice graph that shows that total investment in Canada has consistently been on the decline since 2015.
Yeah, and when normal people talk about budget, they're usually talking about their household finances. And when they talk about having a budget, they're looking more closely at what they're spending and how to manage costs and to try and cut out any unnecessary expenditures so that they can move ahead in their growth. But when it comes to governments, especially this Trudeau Liberal government, seems like the budget is just a way for them to be able to spend money. And all they're doing is racking up more and more debt, which is causing us, as we've said so many times before, to pay more money on that debt, which means that'll be less money available in the future to spend on programs that we could do when the economy is good. And it's just amazing that the people are not only either not talking about the budget, or they're talking about it in positive terms and how they're helping certain groups.
Yeah.
You have to remember that if they're paying, if we're paying more and more into deficits, that's just more and more money that's going to come out of the future. So a lot of governments like to say with their budgets that they're investing in the future, so to speak. But in this case, when you're putting the country into more and more deficit, you're actually doing the exact opposite of investing in the future.
Yeah, and the Bloomberg article explains this. And, you know, it's just it's really disappointing that more and more we need to go to foreign sources to find the news that talks about Canada in the sense of what's actually happening here. Because Bloomberg talks about the foreign direct investment that's coming into Canada. And you can see just by the graph here as to how it is decreasing. And that is what one of the core concerns of this budget document should be, because if you don't have this investment, you don't have a cash flow into Canada, and you're not going to have high profile, very powerful companies wanting to set up new factories or new drilling operations in Canada without that. And if that's not happening, you're not bringing in that tax revenue, and that's bad for everyone involved. So once again, you know, foreign media nails it when it comes to the budget here.
Yeah, and exactly. You can see in the picture that's linked there, you can see that the investment is creeping down towards levels that we haven't seen since the start of the recession, which of course is when there's going to be a low amount of investment. But we're having good times in the economy, sunny ways. But we're seeing foreign investment into our country plummet, and that's going to ultimately pay a cost in jobs, tax revenue, and quality of life when it comes down to it. So It's amazing how people can see this budget as being something good. Sure, it may in the short term be paying money into a lot of social services that probably do need help. But in this case, this is not the way to go about doing it.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week, which is deficit, which is the amount by which something, especially a sum of money, is too small or an excess of expenditure or liabilities over income or assets in a given period. And the example being an annual operating deficit, which is what we're seeing right here in the Canadian national budget. And, you know, the definition of the word deficit says it quite well. And, you know, there is not enough money to go around in terms of what the government wants to spend, and the policies in that budget are not helping it. So,
yeah, to put it quite plainly, the definition of a deficit either means that you don't have enough money to spend on something, or it means that you've spent too much in the past and that you don't have enough assets to cover that. And that's basically what we're seeing here in Canada, and that's a reality that's happening, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we can also extend this to our Alberta story, for example, in that there was a deficit of reporting into Stephen Mandel and his campaign team that led him to clinch the Alberta Party leadership race. Because, I mean, let's be real here. If there was actual coverage of what was going on, I think people might have been more inclined to ask questions regarding that. But there was very little reporting on that during the race. So a deficit of reporting in that regard.
And you could also extend that to the other two stories, the Bloc Québécois as well as the Chinese Insurance Group, because neither of those stories were talked about in full on a lot of websites. They either didn't exist at all, or you'd have to scroll way, 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 way down to the last few articles on a politics page to be able to find something about it. So once again, it seems like not only are we seeing deficits when it comes to the economy, but we're also seeing it in terms of reporting from the mainstream media, which is why we exist, right?
That's right, to provide the story without bias and sensationalism and talk about what the media is not. And speaking of that, if you want full show notes for this episode, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at RightsideCA. And that wraps up this episode of The Right Side, and we'll see you next week for another episode.
That's right, and we'll continue to provide you coverage on stories that the media will not cover, or that they'll cover with a lot of bias and sensationalism, and we'll always cut that out and give you the right context for all of the news stories. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.